In the Unresolved Problem segment today, manipulative people. Big problem these days. For some people, it is perfectly acceptable to manipulate others. It's almost a lifestyle. So how do we protect ourselves against people like that?
About 28 centuries ago, people really admired wisdom. They called it Sophos, and people admired it so much they were willing to pay for it. They would hire Sophos to teach them all manner of things, particularly law and politics. So the Sophos were traveling teachers and poets who roamed the countryside of Greece, and they taught anyone willing to pay to learn. As time went on, these Sophos became the most effective lawyers and gave advice to those governing the new Athenian democracy. After a while, however, Socrates and his student Plato brought up the idea that the Sophists were not all that wise. In fact, they argued, what they were good at was structuring their lessons to simply sound wise. In essence, Socrates and Plato said the Sophists spoke so persuasively and so falsely that they could make listeners believe black was white. Also, Socrates and Plato objected to the fact that the Sophists charged for their services while they, being both wise and noble, dispensed their wisdom for free. They created such an uproar that even to this day, the term Sophist is an insult. Not long after, Aristotle, a student of Plato, finally developed some rules for publicly dispensing wisdom and using language persuasively. He put down all his rules in a book which he called The Art of Rhetoric. In the Art of Rhetoric, Aristotle separated out the wisdom from the skill needed to dispense it. He wrote down rules for arguing, ones that required arguers to be ethical as well as persuasive. He said the arguer should be logical, appeal to emotion, and build his trustworthiness with the audience by being ethical. He also listed 13 tricks or fallacies to avoid in arguing and laid out the ethics he thought an arguer should have. The Art of Rhetoric became essential to lawyers, politicians, priests, and writers. Anyone who wished to persuade a wide audience sought to train in it, and this continues today. Today, unfortunately, the word rhetoric has taken on some of the negative connotation of sophistry. People think of it as eloquent speech designed to deceive. Especially when politicians are involved, calling something rhetoric is a pejorative.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is October 30th. I did that because tomorrow's Halloween. So anyway, I'm still working on editing what is technically the second part of the Trivium series with Gino Denning, the show on logic. But there were a couple interesting portions of the discussion that I decided to edit out of that show because I really wanted to stick to an outline. I really wanted to make sure, considering how dense the next show is going to be, that people walk away with an understanding of the logic portion of the Trivium. So these two stories, both around 15 minutes, had to come out of that show, and I wanted you to be able to hear them. And usually, stuff like this winds up in our bonus content section at schoolsucksproject.com. It's called the AV Club, but people have to pay for access to that. And like I said, I wanted everyone to be able to hear this. And wouldn't you know it, quick check of the old stats reveals that less than 2% of everyone who downloads this podcast is actually in the AV Club. So, lots of underappreciated material languishing there, folks. I'd also invite you, while I'm making requests, to go to our YouTube channel and check out this video series if you haven't done this yet. The Best of John Taylor Gatto, taking excerpts from his book, The Underground History of American Education, and turning them into, you know, hopefully snappy and entertaining 4 to 6 minute videos. The new one is out. It's called The New Dumbness. And actually, a couple of people sent me messages saying that they were surprised I was able to get away with using what appears to be a Guns N' Roses song, Sweet Child of Mine. So anyway, that version of Sweet Child of Mine is just a cover from some guy who has a YouTube channel with hundreds of videos of him covering popular music. His name's Carl Golden. I'd like to give him credit. Carl with a K if you want to look him up. Oh, watch our videos while you're searching for him. Make that, you know, part of the same activity. But what I wanted to point out, when you consider the message of that video, the new dumbness, and what we've been saying and what Gatto has been saying about what school does to children, you know, these creative, energetic, confident, optimistic, individualistic little people. I want you to know, and I think this makes an interesting story for when you go to watch the video, the music in the background, the drummer on that track at the time of the recording was 6. His name is Avery Drummer. He's got his own channel, and I think that's awesome. And just on my end, obviously, you know, Carl Golden, John Taylor Gatto, and this drumming prodigy are examples of the real talent that I'm using to make these videos. But on my end, it did take about 15 hours. And you might say, well, how does somebody find 15 hours in a week to work on something like that? I'd say it boils down to this. I don't have a boss. I don't have somebody who calls me and says, Brett, you got to come back to work. You know, you can't leave in the middle of the day to go home and work on your little YouTube videos. All right? We've got reports that need to be filled out. So I just want to reiterate, I would love your support. The AV Club gets you access to a ton of additional stuff on the website. But for today, I thought these two stories that Gene tells are definitely worth including as an interlude in this series, because these two portions of the conversation might provide us with a little bit of a running start to get into a more in-depth examination of logic in the trivium. So that's what today's show is all about. The first piece deals with the trivium and religion, and also what I describe as a history of the trivium being out of order with respect to persuasion and argumentation. Second piece, baseball. A sport you've heard me talk about on the show before. I say it's a special game. It's different than the other sports. Today, maybe we'll learn why. And I hope you're enjoying these shows with Gene. The logic portion of this series will be along in just a couple days. All right, just on a final note, I'll be up in Keene, New Hampshire this weekend for the Keenevention. All right, see you there.
Many people think of the trivium as being related to religion. And a lot of religious schools or home educating families have a religious focus. I was given these principles without religion coming into the discussion almost at all. Mm-hmm. So it's so general in its extent. The seven liberal arts, not just the trivium, it's so general in its extent. It can be what we call secular, or it can be religious. It applies to humanity, period, to any conceptual being who takes ideas apart and puts ideas together voluntarily. This is conceptual thinking. The only reason I think that it relates so much to religion is because the terms themselves, trivium and quadrivium, which, as I had previously mentioned, I didn't come upon until I was age 33, after having the principles of the seven liberal arts given to me, are Latin, which came out of the period of time that Thomas Aquinas and his teacher, Albertus Magnus, who were both churchmen, supposedly rediscovered Aristotle through the Arabs in Spain, essentially the Arab scholar Averroes was mm-hmm. his name. So they use these Latin terms, which were the lingua franca of the church. This was the universal language of the Roman Christian church. And that's the only place that I can see the idea of the trivium and quadrivium having a connotation with religion at all. Whenever we speak of the classical trivium, or the classical liberal arts, I use that term. Here's another situation where we've got a denotation and a connotation. When I use the word classical, I'm speaking of the Western classical era, which is ancient Greece and Rome.
Right.
And this had very little to do with Christian, essentially ecclesiastical thought. So it's possible for anyone of any persuasion to utilize this. I'm actually happy that the religious demographic has accepted it, because it's something that to me would be, it's not written in stone. This is a framework that we're talking about. It's a framework that I found is a little bit more difficult to introduce to people who want the answer from the authority, who want the answer from the bureaucratic authority that they see is holding valid thought and truth within their purview.
Absolutely. And my tie-in to a religion, and I think what people might have been basing that on, is there are a number of secondary schools and people who attended Catholic schools where they say this method of thinking is made quite explicit, but the logic and the rhetoric phases are overstressed and the grammar piece is really understressed. In other words, Rich and I just had a conversation with Mark Stevens, and we were talking about his exposure to the trivium and his excitement about it. And often grammar is done in a way where, you know, it's said, here's a present called knowledge, don't open it. In other words, don't try to understand the meta grammar of this piece of grammar. Just take it for what it is. And I could see a certain utility to that in I don't want to call it religious indoctrination, but that I think would be the fear that people would have, that understressing grammar, understressing the real components of things, and then just saying, this is applicable everywhere, because it goes to somebody like, well, what's his name? Sam Harris, the atheist who is trying to mount this case against free will. And, you know, he is in his arguments logically flawless. It's beautiful. The logical relationships, the way he works together, works all these things together. But what he demands of his Sam Harris fan boy and girl audience is, you'll accept my definitions at face value. So we'll start off by me as the authority, the knowledge authority, defining free will as this. Now, without any questions about that definition, without opening that present that I've given to you called knowledge, we will work with that definition in logical relationships, and I will prove my case. So I think that might have been part of at least the warning that came my way. Kevin Cole, who I know you're familiar with, has done a lot of work on the classical trivium. He did a really good presentation, and the idea that this was used against people as a means of control as well.
Well, when we get to rhetoric, we'll really be able to see the valid use, the almost unconscious misuse, and again, the very conscious abuse of words, of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
Again, going back to the piece that you introduced from 1984 in our first discussion, I had heard you mention, and I just couldn't place it, I had heard you mention this idea that someone gave a particular definition or a redefinition of something and then proceeded from there. You've actually brought something to my understanding that I previously didn't have until we just had this discussion. I know from having studied a book called The Trivium, written by Sister Miriam Joseph, her last name is Raw, and she taught school at an all-girls Catholic school here in America and put this book together. And again, I found it when I was overseas. I didn't find it here in the U.S. Back when I was age 33. And I could see that she didn't present the trivium as a system, as an integrated system. But I didn't know which part was missing. And you just explained that, and it just makes perfect sense. I mean, that was an epiphany for me when you just said they take out the grammar. And really, they utilize the second portion, which is logic, the part of definition. Here is how I define something, and here's what we'll start our discussion with: my definition or my redefinition of the term. And this leads into this epiphany that I just mentioned, that I just had, is someone comes up to you and asks if you believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I do is ask, how do you define God?
Right.
Not whether I believe in it or not, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But how do you define God? Is it this person with a gender and definite characteristics and a motivation? Or is it a general providence? Is it a centralized force? Or is it inexplicable, but it's something that we use so that we can get our limited consciousness around? So you spend all day just in the definition of force from that simple question: do you believe in God? And what they're trying to do is find, are you someone that I can speak to, or oftentimes that I can manipulate through whatever my discernment of that term is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where you start. Start with definition. And again, going back to my own story, this is when I was being taught the mechanical arts of dentistry by this mentor of mine. This is where we focused, was on this idea of definition. And of course, the inductive and deductive aspects of identification, of definition. And it was for this specialized, of course, mechanical art, which is dentistry, has its own lexicon and so on and so forth. But then he got me to look at the general picture. He says, what you're studying right now is the species of the genus of thought.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a genus, a general way of thinking. And that's why I say when you take these tools and start to focus your mind, you become a big picture thinker. And the small picture is not a chore anymore for you to look at. And it is for those of us who are looking for answers from authorities. It's a chore for us to take these individual thoughts and try to make a whole out of it. So when you start from the whole, when you start from the genus, as you do when defining through genus and differentiation, then it's easier and it really stimulates your curiosity to take it apart, to come to that understanding of that coherent body of knowledge so that it's even in greater focus to you. To the extent that you can explain it cogently to someone else rhetorically.
Right.
So now you see the whole picture, but I very much appreciate that idea that grammar is taken out of much of what we are presented, or the definition is given to you and you cannot vary from the definition that was given.
Uh-huh. Well, right. Well, before we get back on track, I would just say this too. It seems that from my understanding, which is as far as the history and application is somewhat basic, obviously, compared to some people, it seems like there's a history of the trivium out of order. So even though we're going to cover this and, you know, maybe I edit this and put it somewhere else or not, but because we haven't gotten to it yet, but Aristotle comes along and they're probably at that time, 2 centuries into sophistry. Like I think sophistry or the origins, predate Aristotle's arrival by at least a couple hundred years. And, you know, sophistry is just entirely concerned with, well, let's win the argument. So there it's obviously over-focused on rhetoric and any, I don't know if they would have used the word trick, but any trick possible to come out as the winner of the argument is what's employed to the purpose is to win the argument, not to arrive at truth. And he basically says something, obviously I'm paraphrasing, like, if all you care about is winning, you know, you can go throw the discus or something, but I'm interested in the truth. So there we see a shift from rhetoric to an embrace of logic. And even today, like to bring up that Sam Harris example again, he knows that, I mean, like in the mainstream media and political debates, they know they can get away with anything. But there are some more intellectual conversations going on right now where there at least needs to be this adherence to logic. And I remember seeing things that were logically consistent relationships in the public school textbooks for history, like, you know, all like the syllogism, the American government is made up of presidents, A. And then B would be all American presidents are awesome and heroic. So C, the government is awesome and heroic, which is basically what I felt like that's what the books were trying to communicate. And, yeah, I mean, that might be a fine logical relationship, but then finally we add this, adherence or diligence that's required with, grammar to really understand the definitions before we do those things that people in history anyway seem comfortable doing before they had clear definitions.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, definition is usually listed under logic, but now you can see how because you mentioned grammar, that we've got to get that straight in our grammar. Now you see the dance that you were doing. You were using definition, which is a branch of logic, to clarify something in grammar.
Mm-hmm.
So there aren't distinct separations between these three components. And that's why I keep using the metaphor of a dance. or of a spiral that you keep going back and forth to determine, finally, what is truth? You determine truth of a particular proposition through finding valid means of doing this. And the validity, of course, is in deductive thinking. So when you follow the syllogism, the terms of the syllogism, you can more or less get a consistent result from your deductive thinking so that you can bring it back to the truth in an inductive solution or in an inductive description.
So that is the end of clip number one. Here is clip number two.
I don't know why I decided to listen to people when I was a child. Maybe they were making sense to me, and they decided to communicate on this level. I had an uncle who was illiterate. On my mother's side, I'm Hispanic. And a lot of the people in her family didn't speak English. Some of the older people, their first language was Spanish. And this particular uncle was completely illiterate, could not speak, could not read English or Spanish. He usually spoke in Spanish, but he was a semi-pro ball player. And he explained to me he used the term Masonic, the Masonic connections with baseball. And I recently explained this to Laurette Lynn because she has a son who's involved in this, but in baseball. But he explained to me what the meaning underneath he called it the ritual of baseball rather than the game of baseball was. And this is the way that some Masonic explanations, who the Masons are supposed to use symbol and allegory to present their case. And again, by studying symbol and allegory, you have a completely different result. Your result can be more clear-minded. But the idea of baseball, and I must stress that he was brought up and was a practicing Catholic, and especially in my area of the country, at that time, Catholics and Masons didn't seem to be particularly cohesive.
Right.
But he told me that this was explained to him by one of the other players, is that the diamond is formed by the symbol for the Masonic organization, which is the square and the compass. And it forms this diamond pattern when it comes together. And when you speak to Mark Passio, he's more learned in these things than I am. But when you bring that together, the compass on top and the square on the bottom, it forms a diamond. And that is the baseball diamond. And then home plate is set at one corner. And then there's first base, second base, and third base. We're all aware of that. Well, the pitcher, which is on the opposing side, is the accuser. And what he's accusing the batter at home plate, the one that's on offense, the bat can also be the thought of as the magic wand. He's accusing the batter of not being knowledgeable and understanding enough to truly go home. So the ball represents force. And because man often tends to abuse his own kind, force can sometimes be tyrannical. And the bat or the magic wand represents law, and it can be man's law. And oftentimes the law can be used to take this tyrannical force and bring balance, the balance of nature back into the world. So this is the game that's being played. It reflects the game of life. Baseball reflects the game of life. So the accuser throws with force the ball to the one wielding the magic wand. And if he has enough skill, he hits the ball. He hits the force. And if he has enough skill, he might be able to get to first base. Well, this is equivalent, as I understand it, there are three basic degrees in masonry. The first degree is entered apprentice. So if he gets to first base, he will be at the first degree. This represents the first degree of entered apprentice. And then I'll go forward real quickly to second base. And that's a second degree. And I offhand can't think of the name of that degree. But it's consistent, and an internet search will bring this up. And then the third degree is the master mason. And then finally, if you've learned all your lessons, if you've learned the lessons of the balance of what is, or the balance of nature, you can come home to your true home, which is the home in the cosmos. I've since looked it up, and I use that term cosmos. My uncle said, you can come home to the heavens. So the idea is, you must leave home on a journey before you can truly come home to the cosmos. So when you get to first base, and here's the difference between, I believe you have to be 18 or 21, I'm not too sure, if you're first generation to join a Masonic organization. And I guess there are regular and irregular Masons and on and on. But for joining a regular Masonic order, I think there's an age situation to 18 or 21. And when you get to first base, what you're doing is getting rid of your prejudices. Mm-hmm. This is the idea behind the entered apprentice. And when you speak to Mark Passio, he'll call that the interred, that it's a play on words, that it is the interred apprentice. That means that he's buried. He's buried in ignorance. So the interred apprentice must first get rid of his prejudices, or get rid of his superfluities and bad tendencies. I can't think of the name, but there are specific terms for it. And this is preparing you to learn. You must get rid of your prejudices. You must attempt an open mind. You must be prepared to come out of the grave in which you're buried, the grave of ignorance. So if you make it to second base, this is the second degree. And here is where you're taught how to learn and how to think. At second base is where you're given the seven liberating arts. And if you've properly gotten rid of your prejudices back here at first base, the first degree, you can now advance to the second degree, where you are given these tools of the trivium and quadrivium. Then finally, you go to third base, and you are now the master mason. And what this means is you are now qualified to coach others beneath you, your brothers who are coming up through the ranks. The best way to learn is to teach. So now you know how to learn and think yourself as a master mason, and you refine your skills and abilities by teaching your brothers behind you, and also to continue learning yourself. And the object is that you learn the balance of nature before you come home, when you truly come home, when you make that last trek into home plate. And now you can take your place, an enlightened being, because you are in tune with the balance of nature. And again, this is home with capital H-O-M-E, home in the cosmos. And sometimes this happens in one fell swoop, and you make the home run, of course. And all the people that are in position can come home to the cosmos with you. But the point, the illustration I'm trying to get to here is that first base, that first degree, you're already to the point, having reached young adulthood, where you have to eliminate prejudice. Whereas a child, starting to get the trivium in particular, already starting to get what the Mason would get at second base, does not have to get rid of the prejudice to the degree that he who is buried in his own mind, in his own ignorance, has to.
And removing prejudice is seeing things as they actually are. So
it's the attempt. It's the preparation. Yeah.
But in that,
you have to explicitly know at that point in life that you are holding prejudices, because now you're buried in ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go back to the model that Dorothy Sayers suggests, and which I was given, which is to get these concepts at an earlier time when you don't have to get rid of prejudice, you don't have to concentrate energy on that. You can start to just let this, as I say, start running in the background. And after a while, every few years, it comes back into your consciousness that this pattern has become habituated. And I go for years, sometimes decades, without thinking about these things. And I look back and I'm thinking, well, yeah, this pattern is still operative within me. But it's all over the place. These concepts are, some people say they're hidden in plain sight.
You know, maybe this is why baseball as a game is so dramatically different from every other sport that people play and like in this country and pretty much around the world, which really just seems to be an interpretation of the unenlightened state of warfare, where two sides line up. And behind each side, there is a goal that the offense wants to get to and the defense tries to protect. And that's true for everything from football to ping pong, right? But baseball, which is one of the reasons why, even though I'm not following sports as closely as I once did, has always stood out to me as a unique and special kind of game. Because it's so different, it seems more enlightened as a sport than everything else. And that explanation is just fascinating to me.
Well, again, this illiterate, poorly spoken man essentially never had his curiosity tampered with, because he never spent a day in school. Number one, he never spent a day in Catholic catechism.
Mm-hmm.
But he understood, and he called it, again, going back to our also and, he said he had never been inside a Masonic temple. And evidently in the lodge hall, I've been inside Masonic halls, and they all have a tessellated floor, a black and white checkerboard floor. And there have been multiple explanations given to me from Masons. I'm not a Mason. I've never belonged to any society which requires an oath. And I've never given an oath other than to my wife. But evidently, when you go in there, this is supposed to indicate chessboard. And also that it is the place for starting to get rid of your prejudices. The black and white floor is the threshing floor. This is where you separate the wheat from the chaff. The wheat being the white squares, the enlightened squares, and the chaff being the useless squares, the prejudicial squares over here. But especially nowadays, when you look at baseball on TV, or if you go to the ballpark, especially professional baseball, you'll see the outfield with that pattern, with that checkerboard pattern, which is to indicate mm-hmm. that this game is reflective of life itself, that it is a game. But on the other hand, getting back to my uncle, he called it a ritual. He says this, and he was making the same observation that you are. This is unlike other games. It's not timed, for one thing. And what it does is, through its ritual, it unites people, but also divides them. It unites the community in which it's in, and yet divides you from the other community which is coming to play you. So it's a method to ritualize both unity and division. Yeah, he had some pretty profound, I consider them quite profound, understandings that he derived from being a semi-pro baseball player and having contact with these men who explained this to him.
I love that story.